Hi, welcome to Never Too Much True Crime. My name is Amaya, welcome. I started a series where I talk about true crime every week. If you love true crime as much as I do, let's get started. This week's case is about John Wayne Gacy. John Wayne Gacy was born on March 17, 1942 in Chicago, Illinois. Born the second child out of three kids, John came from an abusive household. His father, being an alcoholic, would abuse John, his siblings, and their mother. His father would also verbally abuse him and belittle him every chance that he got. One of his childhood friends would say that if John was too late for something, then his father would starve him. So John would have to go to his friend's house in order to eat food, and he would also spend the night there. Abuse comes in many different forms. It's a horrible experience, especially when it's from someone like your boyfriend, girlfriend, mother, father, sister, someone who's supposed to love you and protect you. Some parents aren't meant to be parents. Why have a kid if you're just going to project your pain onto them? That doesn't sit right with me. John would continue being abused by his father. He would try to please his father, but no matter what John did, his father always projected his pain and anger onto him, beating him with belts, brooms, and not only that, but John had a heart condition, so it was hard for him to play sports. He would isolate himself a lot because of these things that were happening in his life. When John was 11, an accident happened where he was hit by a swing across his forehead. I wanted to talk about that more. I've realized something about serial killers. Not all of them, but most of them that suffer from a head injury, eventually they always end up doing something violent or having a lot of anger. You guys can let me know what you think about that. By 1966, John is 24 years old. He gets married and moves to Waterloo, Iowa. From the outside, his life was great. He had a good job, having two kids. Right? Wrong. John had a double life. He was sexually interested in young boys. One day, he lured a boy back to his home and sexually assaulted him. Boy ends up telling his father what happened to him. John gets arrested. John would hire a teenager to go threaten the kid so that the kid wouldn't testify against him. It didn't work. The kid still testified against him. Unfortunately, there wasn't any solid proof of assault. John was charged with sodomy. John's family didn't believe that he was capable of doing something like this. His family thought that he was being set up. You know, it's not true. He wasn't this type of person. His family really thought that he was a good guy. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison on December 3rd, 1968. His wife would soon divorce him while he's in jail, and he would never see his kids again. Around that time, his father would pass away. He wasn't able to go to his funeral. While John was supposed to be in jail for 10 years, he somehow manipulated his way into having a lesser sentence, only having to serve 18 months instead of the 10 years. June 1970, John is released from prison. He ends up buying a home with his mom and starts living at home with her. 2 years later, he would start his own business, the PDM Contractors. He was also part of a local Democratic Party. People around him didn't know anything of his criminal background, so it made it easier for him to adapt and start a new life for himself because nobody didn't know what he was doing or what he was capable of. June 1972, John gets married again. They move into a home, 8213 West Summerdale Avenue. In December 1978, Rob Peast, I hope I'm pronouncing his last name right. I'm sorry if I'm butchering these names, was reported missing. Detectives Mike Albrecht, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, and Dave Hackmaster started the investigation. Rob was known as a great kid who never got in trouble, so it was odd that he was missing. Before Rob's disappearance, he worked at a pharmacy. He told his mother he was going to talk to a contractor about a job. He went outside and he was never seen again. Investigators were trying to find Rob as quickly as possible to see if they could track down this contractor. They located John. At this point, John is living alone. Him and his second wife would get a divorce. You see, John would employ young men to work for him. John's sister explained how he complained a lot that he had to hire young boys to work for him for his company, and she would tell him, like, why not get adults? or people that have experience. And his response was that he could only afford to hire young boys to work for him. Keep that in mind. One of the boys that he employed was Tony Antonucci. He was 16 at the time looking for a job. Tony said that John was a very likable guy, always telling jokes. He seemed like a normal person. Rob is still missing. While investigators are still looking for him, they find out that John had a very long criminal record, sexual crimes against children. This raised their suspicion. A boy was reported missing, and somehow this contractor guy that the boy was talking to has a criminal background. They get a search warrant to check his home. December 13th, 1978, police, they start searching his home. They found weird objects like pornography, a book that said pretty boys must die. They found driver's license of young people. When police ran a check on them, they found out that the driver license matches all of the kids who were reported missing at that time. Police were hoping that Rob was still alive, but there was a very slim chance. They also found a ring that belonged to 19-year-old John Zick, who was reported missing too. He was last seen on January 1977. That's when investigators realized that these two boys that worked for John were reported missing. 17-year-old John Bukovich, who was last seen on July 1975, and Gregory Godzik, who was missing on December 1976. It was hard for police to find any solid evidence against John. All they had were just the weird items they found in his home. This time, police were really confident that John had something to do with these kids disappearing. Police began to keep a close eye on John. They decided to have a friendly approach against John instead of being aggressive. John knew he was being followed and would have conversations with the police. But behind closed doors, John would make phone calls to his sister about how he's being followed and it was the police and how they are suspecting that he did something. While they were eavesdropping on John, they noticed how cocky he was and always bragging about having a business. People that are controlling and people like John who uses manipulation tactics to get what he wants, I've noticed that he cares about image, making himself look as friendly as possible, making sure that he is likable by others, but deep down inside, he isn't friendly at all. He just wants to gain people's trust. So if something bad happens, then people will automatically defend his character. This is how I viewed it and how I see things. You know, I've met people who are like this, where they just care about their image and not being portrayed as a bad guy, but behind closed doors, they're doing horrible things to other people. It could be your coworker, it can be a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a family member. It is extremely common. John, being a very charming guy, it worked. Everyone around him loved him. It just goes to show that a lot of times people will wear a mask, but deep down inside, they're just rotten. People were blinded by his charm, definitely. Police had to remind themselves that John is dangerous and that they have to catch him because his charm started to work on the police. That's how good he was at manipulating people and having power over people. John was heavily involved with the community. On weekends, he would dress up as a clown, Pogo the Clown, and perform for kids. That's extremely disturbing, the fact that he was always surrounded by children. Investigators tried to get a second search warrant. They received new evidence when they questioned his colleagues. John would order the kids to look at his crawl space and made them dig trenches, lying to them about how there was a sewage issue. The kids said that he made them dig up trenches several times and there was a foul odor down there. Also, when police would go to John's home because they were watching him and they were all sitting down, one of the police officers asks John, can he use the bathroom? And in the bathroom, there was like this vent. And the police officer said that there was a foul stench. It smelled like death in the bathroom. Police suspected that there was a body down there. Detectives continued to follow John around to see if they might find more evidence. They knew it would be hard to catch John considering that everyone in town loved him. So they had to be careful how they would catch him and came up with a plan to put pressure on his supporters and friends. Eventually, everybody started to pull away from John, you know, take away his support system, make people see him in a different light. Police tells John that they're getting another search warrant. This makes John very uneasy. Around midnight, 1 a.m., John goes to contact his attorney. The police arrives to talk to his attorney. The attorney tells them Like, hey, don't let John go anywhere if he tries to leave, like block him. Police don't know what's going on. They assume that John has confessed to something. Police continue to follow John, and his behavior started to change drastically. Very emotional, all over the place. Police would arrest John for marijuana possession and delivery. John was trying to buy more time, so he created a fake story about him having chest pains, so they took him to the hospital. December 21st, 1978, they searched his home a second time. I forgot to add this. The first time they searched the home, they did go into the crawl space the first time, but they couldn't find anything. So the second time they search his home, they go to the crawl space. They start digging and digging. It took a while, but they found remains. John gets arrested for murder. John tells police that he can draw a map where all the bodies were buried. He had a perfect memory of where everybody's body was. The fact that he remembered exactly where everyone was buried is so creepy. I couldn't believe it. It was so disturbing to know that this man remembered where everybody was down there over those years. It's crazy how he was able to live a normal life, go to work, and come back home and do this to young boys. It's very disturbing. John would confess to killing 33 young boys from 1972 through 1978. One of the kids he buried in his backyard. The other five in the Des Plaines River. One of the bodies that were found floating in the river was Rob. John would explain how he killed his victims in gruesome details. He also told police his tricks and what he would do to lure these boys into his home. While John was outside talking to Rob, Rob tells him to get in the car so he can fill in an application. Rob was never seen after that until they discovered his body. He would lure Rob to his house where he showed him car tricks, the handcuff trick. Rob asks John, how do you do that? John is like, put the handcuffs on yourself. I'll show you how to do that. John's method of killing was him finding kids that ran away from home. They didn't have any financial support. Kids that he could easily manipulate and have power over. He would give them drinks and trick them. He used chloroform on his victims. He would use a rope and put it over their neck. When he described the murders, he was talking like he was proud of what he has done. He explained every detail, again, of how he killed every victim, 33 in total. The media goes crazy over this case. Tony Antonucci realizes that John tried to do the same thing to him. Police were able to identify 22 out of the 33 victims. On February 6, 1980, the trial begins at the Cook County Criminal Courts building in Chicago. John's defense team were trying to use the insanity card in court. They had different psychiatrists do evaluations on John. They were saying different things. The trial was 5 weeks long. March 13, 1980, John was found guilty and was sentenced to death and taken to the Menard Correctional Center in Illinois. He was on death row for 14 years. He would start painting and selling them for money. May 1992, John tried to say that he wasn't guilty of the murders, but it was too late. He already confessed. Not only was John narcissistic, but he had a very hard time taking responsibility when he has done something wrong. He started to blame the victims and blame everybody else for his actions instead of taking accountability for all the horrible things that he has done over these years. It's interesting, but it's also scary at the same time how someone can just lie like that and manipulate to get out of that situation. He thought that he was going to be able to smooth talk his way out of the situation. May 10th, 1994, John was executed by lethal injection. His last words before the lethal injection was, and I quote, "Kiss my ass." That was a lot. Oh my goodness. The fact that he was doing all of this in the span of a couple of years is mind-blowing to me. Imagine if he didn't get caught and he kept doing this, or he didn't get caught until 10 years later, 5 years later. Imagine. It just sucks how kids, young kids, teenagers are often preyed on by predators. It sucks. It sucks that he was doing this to these kids. All they wanted to do was have a better life for themselves. They wanted to make money. They wanted to live their lives, and he took that away from them. It's a very heartbreaking thing. My heart goes out to the families. I'm glad that they found him, they caught him, and he's no longer here, which is good because we don't need anybody like that roaming around in the streets. I might have to take a break after this, but this case really took a mental toll on me. There's also a documentary about John. It's on Netflix. Basically, there's like voice recording, so you guys can watch it if you want to, just to get more of an insight of what kind of person he was and how he was able to manipulate and charm his way. And the way that he would talk to people, he sounded like a normal person. He was very calm, collected. It was like talking to an uncle or a family member. He didn't seem aggressive or didn't seem like this horrible human being, but he was. And again, it's very scary that these people could be your mom, your sister, anybody, coworker, boss, anyone. You never really know someone, right? You never really know someone. Some people out here, there are some people out here who are living double, triple lives and doing things that they have no business doing and harming other people. And that's it for this week's Never Too Much True Crime. I'll see you guys next week with a brand new Never Too Much True Crime case. And that's it. Peace out, guys.